Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Today's program is being held in association with the Marines Memorial Association. I'm George Scalise, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and will be the chair for today's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the Internet on commonwealthclub.org and the Marines Memorial Association at marinesclub.com. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, General Martin Dempsey, Chairman of the United States Joint Chiefs of Staff. General Dempsey serves as the 18th Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. In this capacity, he is the principal military advisor to the President, the Secretary of Defense, and the National Security Council. Graduated from the United States Military Academy in 1974 and holds master's degrees in military art, national security studies, and English. In 1991, he deployed with the 3rd Armored Division in support of Operation Desert Storm. Following that mission, he went on to serve on the Joint Staff as Special Assistant to the Chairman. From 2003 to 2005, he was in command of the 1st Armored Division in Baghdad. After the division was deployed to Germany, General Dempsey returned to Iraq in 2007 to train the Iraqi security forces. Following year, he served as Deputy Commander, then Acting Commander of the U.S. Central Command. 2011, he was appointed Chief of Staff of the Army, and later that year, named Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. General Dempsey is the highest-ranking military officer in the nation. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome General Martin Dempsey.
Thank you. I always wanted to do that. Very impressive how quiet you got when George started swinging the mallet. Deanie and I are delighted to be here in San Francisco, one of America's great cities, to have a chance to chat with you about our military profession, about our security, and about the future. And there's plenty to talk about, as you well know. I'm told that there may be some wounded warriors in the audience. If there are, would you raise your hand so I can find you? Let's give them a round of applause, huh? I'd like to chat with you later, introduce myself to you. Thanks for your service. So here we are at the top of the mark. I'm a bit of an amateur historian, so I did look back in the history of this great hotel. And you may know, some of you, that in World War II, this room was a gathering place for some of the troops that were about to ship out into the Pacific Theater of Operations, and this was often the place they'd spend their last night together with their spouses and sweethearts. And I'm told that one corner or another of the room, and I'll have to ask the proprietor to point it out to me, was called Weeper's Corner, because the spouses, as they parted company, would come into the corner and look out the window to watch them sail out to sea. I don't know if that's a true story or not, but it makes for a great introduction. Because here we are many, many years later, and we're still deploying our young men into various parts of the world where their services are needed on behalf of the country. A couple of things. George asked me on the way up here, you know, how often do I get to do things like this? And I said that I aspire to do things like this about once a month, because it's part of my responsibility to stay connected to America, to make sure that you understand what we're seeking to accomplish, how we're adjusting ourselves to new security environments, new fiscal environments, all the different changes that you see going on around you, and certainly you know they affect us as well. I'm in California, notably, this week because I've bundled together a series of engagements that I've wanted to take for some time. And we started at Edwards Air Force Base and Palmdale, where, as you know, we do a lot of our work on stealth technology, electronic warfare, and things. And then I made my way into the Silicon Valley to meet with the giants, really, of the cyber industry. Whether they're chip makers or operating systems or cybersecurity experts, venture capitalists, startups, because I wanted to gauge their, not only their interest, but also their concerns about the future of cyber. And so I accomplished that. And we can chat about that if you'd like. We also then spent some time with up at Stanford with the Hoover Institute. And now here I am today closing out what has been, I think, for me anyway, a part of what I call my campaign of learning, because if I had to describe one particular leader attribute in the world in which we find ourselves, I would suggest to you that leaders have to continue to learn about the context in which all of these very important issues are being are being resolved. So the second thing I want to talk to you about is just to frame this for you is a few words about what I think is the state of security in the world. You know, I grew up in Bayonne, New Jersey, and at the height of the Cold War, when the possibility of a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union actually felt real. And some of you, like I, remember the drills in grammar school, and where you'd get under your desk and at the alert, and then they'd sound the all clear, and you'd go back to work. And you know, looking back now that I know something about nuclear energy, you wonder, what, that desk wasn't going to do me much damn good, to tell you the truth. But anyway, when I've talked to folks about the security environment today, I describe it as a paradox. Because on the one hand, there are some, notably in academia, who argue persuasively that the world has experienced an era of peace that is unheard of in the history of mankind. There's less violence on a massive scale in the world today than at any time in the recorded history of the human race. And it's actually true. On the other hand, the ability to impose violence and to coerce these groups that are not just nation states but are non-state actors and transnational criminal organizations is changed dramatically, and in particular in the last 10 years. And I always use the example of the massacre in Mumbai, India in 2008. And let me tell you why I use that example. In 2008 in Mumbai, India, some terrorists from Pakistan, the LET, entered the city. There were 10 of them. And in the course of 3 days, they killed 200 and wounded 300. And they maneuvered themselves in and around Mumbai for 3 days into about five or six different locations. And the way they did that, by the way, was by being connected to a command post that actually sat back in Pakistan, in one of the uncontrolled parts of Pakistan. And in that command post, I mean, it was a command post that I would recognize as a command post in our own force. They had flat screen televisions up. They were live streaming most of the major news outlets. They were Googling. They were texting. They were using things that are essentially commercial off-the-shelf technologies in order to maneuver this force, to keep it away from the Indian forces, to send it where they knew that there were pockets of people they wanted to fundamentally wanted to kill them. And in fact, in some ways, they used the cell phone back to this command center to actually pick out their victims. So they'd come into a room, they'd ask who this person was in this particular hotel room. Naturally, they were looking to try to avoid killing any of their own, anyone sympathetic to their view. They wanted, mostly they were after wealthy Indian businessmen and Westerners. Westerners were pretty easy to identify, but some of the Indian elite were not. And what they would do is they would take their identification, call it back to the command center. The command center would Google it, fundamentally, find out who the person really was, call back and say, kill him. So this is the world in which we live, where though massive amounts of violence are less prominent, the security environment is actually it's just more dangerous, I think, in general than it has been, or at least it feels as this way, than any time in my lifetime. So that's the kind of the security paradox. And, you know, I want to make it clear, I'm not establishing my belief in this security paradox as a way of arguing for a greater budget share. In fact, that security paradox doesn't take me to want a bigger military. It takes me to a place where I wanted to help design a better military, a more relevant military, a more adaptable military. And I think we're on the way to doing that, although we have a great deal of work to do. The other thing I want to talk to you about is, especially because you sit here on the shores of the great Pacific Ocean, is this notion of rebalancing our security interests into the Pacific, into the Asia Pacific. And I want to, I had a very lengthy conversation up at Hoover about what it was and what it isn't. And so I want to add some clarifying thoughts for you and then potentially follow up with you in Q&A. The rebalancing to the Pacific, first and foremost, it's almost a statement of the obvious. I mean, all of the world's demographic, economic, and military trend lines are trending from Europe, notably, through the Mideast and into the Pacific. So this is about us looking to the future. This is not something we intend to accomplish today, tomorrow, this year, next year, even 5 years from now. It's something we want to have begin today. And we want to look to about 2020 to have achieved some measure of a rebalancing so that we are postured where we think security challenges are likely to occur, where we think economic interest will continue to reside. And it is important for me to note that the first step in this journey is really a shifting, if you will, of our intellectual bandwidth. So we've been rather significantly interested and, one might argue, consumed by the Mideast for the past 10 years. And so every week I have a video teleconference with the commander of Central Command. I have 400 young men and women who we call the Afghanistan-Pakistan hands, who have done nothing but immerse themselves to understand the issues in that part of in the CENTCOM area of responsibility. So the first step in rebalancing to the Pacific is really to take some of our intellectual bandwidth and begin to shift it. And that's an important point, I think. The second point is we need to engage our partners in the Pacific now that we can, that we have some capacity with notably the war in Iraq ended and the war in Afghanistan beginning to diminish. We have some capacity now that we can apply to engage partners in the Pacific in a more positive way. And then the third thing is we look to deploy some of our most capable, kind of our highest quality equipment into the Pacific so that we become comfortable with operating with our newest technologies in that area of the world. So that's what it is. Let me be clear about what it's not. It's not a containment strategy against China. And I've said this at every opportunity, and I've engaged my Chinese counterparts to make that clear. I actually am of the belief that the real risk we run in a miscalculation or misperception with China would be if we were absent from the Pacific. I mean, we are an historic Pacific power. You can vouch for that. In fact, this, by the way, is also the western edge of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because we're a member of NATO, and therefore NATO has a Pacific shoreline, something that when I pointed it out to my 27 partners in NATO actually shocked them a bit, and as well as Canada, who is also a Pacific power and a member of NATO. So we've got genuine interest. We've got a real opportunity here, I think, to rebalance ourselves, to avoid miscalculation and misperception, to reach out to partners, to give them some confidence that the United States will remain a Pacific power. And I think that is a very important message so that we do avoid a potential miscalculation or misperception with China in the future. The last thing that we've said in our new defense strategy is related to this issue of partners. And We've been carrying a pretty heavy load for the world for a very long time, and we will continue to do that. We are a global power. I don't think anyone in this room would aspire to be anything less than a global power. We'll remain a global power, but we need to work with partners more to share some of the great burdens that we've been carrying over the past, certainly the past 60 or 70 years. And that's an important, we can talk about that if you like as well. The last thing I'll do is talk to you a bit about the force. You know, this thing called the Armed Forces of the United States, approximately 2.4 million men and women in uniform, times three if you can, and as we count the family members that are part of the military family. And I'm often asked about, you know, there's a lot of questions coming in there, George. maybe I better keep talking. I'm asked every place I go, internal to the United States, notably though, externally, you know, do these new fiscal realities, the new fiscal environment that, you know, pick your way to describe it, the age of austerity, is this all going to cause the United States military to find itself in decline? And my answer to that is just a resounding no. It will not. Look, we're going to get a little smaller than we've been for the past 10 years, but I've lived in the military and gone through three of these periods of time when we've just made changes. And we went from, I'll use the Army as an example because I'm more familiar with its end strength. We had about 1 million men under arms in the Army in Vietnam. Shortly thereafter, we went down to 781,000, and everyone predicted that would be the end of the United States Army as we knew it, and it wasn't. And then we took that army to Desert Storm, as you heard George mention. And after that, we, as you recall, we decided that we would reap a bit of a peace dividend, and we took the army down to about 525,000. It eventually went down to about 484, and then 9/11 occurred, and we grew it, and today it sits at about 570,000 active, and about another 300,000 or so in the Guard and Reserve. And we're going to bring it back because of the Budget Control Act and because the nation has some economic challenges that we do believe we should be part of in helping solve, because national power is the sum of economic, diplomatic, and military power. We can't stay on the sidelines of any challenge when America faces it, and we won't stay on the sidelines of this one. And we'll shrink it a bit, but we'll make it the kind of force that provides options for the nation, so that when the president calls, we can respond. And you have my assurances about that. Now, if you ever wonder if I'm making these assurances without confidence, maybe if you have a chance, talk to those wounded warriors and check their resolve. You know, check, or any soldier, sailor, airman, or marine, or Coast Guardman you encounter. Ask them what they think about a military in decline. And my message is that as long as we keep those who wear the uniform inspired by the act of serving their country, as long as we keep faith with them that we will continue to make them the best trained, the best led, the best equipped force on the planet, no matter how big we are. And we have some options on sizing this thing. And we have some options because of new capabilities that are just available to us that weren't available 10 years ago. But it's about the people. So when people ask me, you know, if you look back, if 4 years from now you're retiring out of the military, you're giving up the job of chairman, how will you measure whether you've succeeded or not? And my answer is, if I get the people right, then the force will be able to adapt to whatever the nation asks it to do, and the nation will be proud of that force. But if we get the people wrong, if we fail to inspire them, fail to care for them, fail to maintain a relationship of trust with them, then we do have problems. So if you're wondering what you should watch out for, it's really not how many ships we have or how many brigade combat teams or how many bombers we have or even where we are. Just keep in touch with the people who serve, who wear this uniform and that uniform and the other uniform. As long as you keep faith with them, then you can sleep secure at night because somebody will be out there walking point. Okay, I'm ready for questions.
Okay, well, thank you, General, and certainly we do have a lot of questions. I'm not sure how we're going to cover all of them, but I don't think we will, but we'll give it our best. There are several of them dealing with the Budget Control Act, the sequestration program that's in there that reduces your budget by some $50 billion a year for the next 10 years. And you kind of touched on that, but the question, I guess, is you made a comment a couple of weeks back saying this is an unacceptable risk that will increase the likelihood of conflict. What do you mean by that? Please expand on it a little bit.
Yeah, the comment was about sequestration, actually. But let me talk to you about the Budget Control Act. So the day after I become the chairman is when I received the Budget Control Act decision. Now, that is, you're looking for the definition of a bad day as the chairman. You know, here, congratulations. You know, here's the budget you submitted. Now, fine. It wasn't actually 500. It was $487 billion over 10 years. So a couple of thoughts about that. The first thing that we wanted to do, importantly, was get the service chiefs into the conversation. And the joint chiefs, I got to tell you, the joint chiefs, and by the way, the joint chiefs are me and my vice chairman, and then the chiefs of the Army, Navy, and Air Force and Marines, and then the chief of the National Guard Bureau. So we got together in a room and committed to tackling this on, look, remember I said, we really believed that we had to help the nation solve some of its economic problems. So the first thing we decided was we weren't going to adopt the Heisman Trophy position and begin to, become just another special interest group inside of the government. And so we took it on board and we said, let's see if we can really do this. The second thing we did is, in the context of working it together, we decided to take a look at the existing strategy. That is the strategy that came out of the last quadrennial defense review. And start the process by ripping it apart and deciding where we had opportunities to change the way we do things. I don't want to give you a military history lesson here, but there's a guy named Clausewitz who back in the 18th century, early part of the 19th century, wrote about what is strategy, and it's the aggregate of the ends or the objectives you seek, the means or the resources, and the ways. And any strategy at any time in the history of military conflict has always had to account for all three, ends, ways, and means. So if anybody tells you that resources have just, you know, you're not supposed to worry about resources until you do your strategy, it's nonsense. The strategy is always resource-informed and has to be resource-sensitive. So we agreed on that as a group. And then we agreed, importantly, not to go our own ways. You know, we agreed that we wouldn't go over and start arguing that we needed more Army or more Navy. Or, you know, we said we're going to figure out what the nation really needs, and then we're going to map it to the strategy, and we'll see how it comes out. And then we'll get in a room with our leadership in the Department of Defense, and, you know, we'll have some very tough conversations. And we did that. So we actually adapted our strategy and found a way to map the budget, the 2013 through 17 budget to it. But look, the work isn't done yet. One of the things we said was we got to look out to 2020. You know, we can't keep looking at the world 1 year at a time. We got to look a little deeper than that. Why did we pick 2020? Two reasons. One is you can get sucked into worrying about tomorrow and stay there. But that happens. You don't have to worry about that. You do get sucked into today. The second thing is it's obvious, you know, everybody's willing to talk about 2030. You know, if we're at a cocktail party and I want to talk to somebody about the distant future, you'll sign right up. And we'll be exchanging ideas about global warming and demographic shifts and economic trends and the Eurozone and 2030. And you know why we're so willing to talk about 2030? Because we're not really going to be held accountable for it. No, really. That's why people are more than willing to talk about 2030. But get somebody to talk about 2020. Even a business. I asked a question yesterday at Facebook, which was a great visit, by the way. I said, hey, look, you know, I know you just got some dodgy financial news today, and I got, you know, you'll fight through that. But I said, what is Facebook in 2020? Crickets. It's a hard question. It's a really hard question. So we took it on. What do we want to look like in 2020? And then we're going to march to it. And we don't get just one at bat. You know, we submit a five-year budget every year. So my last budget submission with the chiefs will be the 16-20 budget, meaning 2016 through 2020. So we looked out to 2020. And my report to you is that the budget we submitted will accomplish the needs of the nation out through 2017, and we'll work 18, 19, and 20 as we work toward the next budget cycle. But, you know, we also got to partner with the Congress of the United States, because they are, by Constitution, actually chartered with raising and sustaining the armed forces of the United States. So as we submit the budget, they have some concerns. We bounce it back and forth, and we work to figure it out. And, you know, it's hard work. It's why I try to get out of Washington every once in a while. But we're okay. Sequestration, though, another story. I don't know if you want to talk about sequestration.
I think touching on it would probably at least satisfy some of the questions I have.
Okay, here's the problem with sequestration. First of all, it's another $500 billion, you know? And as I said, I know how hard it was to get where we are with the $487 billion cut. And there's probably some of you in the room to think you can still do a lot more. Of course we probably could, given the time to figure it out, to keep the thing in balance. If we had the ability to affect the entire force, infrastructure, bases, manpower, modernization, training, and operations. It's no magic in a military budget. You get about six places to put it. If you put too much in one bucket or the other, it gets out of balance, and then you end up with a force that you've heard described as hollow. The problem with sequestration is it's an 8% cut across the board in the first year, which means I and the service chiefs lose complete control on how to absorb the cut. So it was designed to be mindless. It is. And so it's not possible for us to keep the force in balance to where we're putting enough money into modernization, enough into manpower, enough into maintenance, training, and operations. Not possible. That's what makes sequestration so devastating, and that's why I've described it, that it would truly affect our stature as a global power.
There are many questions here with regard to cyber issues, cyber defenses in particular. And so I'm going to just try to summarize it by this one question. Does the U.S. need to debate a 21st century version of civil defense against a cyber attack like 9/11 and other low probability, high catastrophe future national security events?
I hadn't thought about it in terms of the civil defense aspect of it. It's intriguing. It might be a way to break the to break what is a kind of a contentious debate right now. But look, the issues about, let me tell you about cyber in general. First of all, think about if we'd have even said the word to each other 10 years ago, if we'd have said the word cyber, we would have been speaking in a foreign language. The fact that now we understand kind of what it means tells you how quickly we've gone from nothing to darn near everything. And we are so dependent on that network that it is extraordinarily difficult to kind of parse it out into segments. So, you know, the private sector, those who produce chips, who produce operating systems, who produce cybersecurity solutions, the defense industrial base, you know, shipbuilders and airplane builders, tank builders, and then, of course, the critical infrastructure of the United States, electrical grids, water systems, all of it rides on cyber. And so, all of it is dependent on this information flow that is enabled by cyber. So, you know, we could debate about the threat all day, actually, and we do a lot of that, debating about the threat. But I can just assure you it's very real. And we have a responsibility, it seems to me, to have that conversation about the degree to which we want to address that threat. And some of it has to do with privacy issues. I concede that. And some of it has to do, by the way, with liabilities for corporations who might share information, and in sharing information might expose themselves to some judicial liabilities. So we're trying to find a reasonable first step. We won't get where we need to be in one step. It's not that kind of issue. It's too important. It's too contentious. And so we've got to take it a step at a time. But it is a very real threat, and it is one that will only get worse, and we have to take it seriously. And from a military perspective, some of you may know, I have authority and responsibility and the capability to protect the .mil domain. But everybody else is kind of responsible for protecting themselves. And I'm not sure that's possible to tell you the truth. And so the conversation we need to have with America, with the Congress of the United States, is if the military has a capability to do something, either before the event or immediately thereafter at network speed, because this is not something you can do over a telephone after it happens. This happens so rapidly that, I mean, it literally happens at network speed. We need to decide what role does America want the military to play in that issue. And that is a conversation we need to have.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guest today is General Martin Dempsey, Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is discussing security challenges and the future of the American military. Let me go on to the next question now. Kind of swinging back to a more traditional set of issues. China seems to be moving into the areas surrounding China in the South China Sea and so on, stirring up a little bit of dust. We wonder just what is happening there, what is the view that you have with regard to our readiness to deal with that issue? Is it one that we're concerned about? Is it something that is really not much of an issue? How do you view that today?
No, it is an issue. I mean, a China that is reemerging. You know, that's when I have my conversations with my Chinese counterparts, they're quick to say we're not an emerging power. You know, it's not like we haven't been around for 5,000 years, but they are reemerging after several decades of essentially being off the global stage. And in their reemergence, they're asserting some claims that that they feel existed before the international order left them behind. And so, again, I'm just giving you their narrative, if you will, as we discuss these issues with them, you know, that the international, some of the international norms that were established during their quote-unquote absence are not applicable because they weren't part of establishing them during their absence. So look, that is a perspective. And by the way, as I've learned about what it means to be chairman, I've reached out to several of men and women who I'm sure have name recognition to you, some of the greatest thinkers of our time, and Henry Kissinger's chief among them, actually, in terms of China. And Henry Kissinger, when I asked him, I said, how should I approach China or Iran or Pakistan or India? I mean, you know, or Great Britain, for that matter. You know, all of the different countries with whom the United States has to have some kind of relationship at some level, Russia. And he said, well, you know, generally said, let me just leave you with this thought. It's important that you know the psychology of those with whom you interact. Now, naturally, it's one of those moments where I wrote it down, and I'm thinking, that's really sounds important. I'm going to have to think about what it means. But I knew right away it was important, but I didn't know how important, because it was exactly the right answer to my question. You know, how should I begin to engage with my counterparts? And his answer was, understand their perspective before you roll in and try to, to convince them of yours. It doesn't mean we don't roll in and try to convince them of ours. And in the case of China, we have some very important national interests in terms of freedom of navigation, the maritime domain, the free access to resources, you know, trade balances and so forth. And we should and are standing our ground on those issues that are directly related to us, where they rub uncomfortably with Chinese assertions. And one of the assertions that George, you alluded to in South China Sea is the nine dash line. You know, their assertion about their exclusive economic zone and territorial waters. Well, we're going to find places where what I just said about our perspective and what they have said about theirs are going to, you know, they're going to rub uncomfortably, and they are. I think what's important, back to our rebalancing in the Pacific, is we really couldn't have that conversation with them if we were doing it, you know, absent from the Pacific. And so getting back and reestablishing relationships with the Filipinos, with the Thais, even Vietnam, SecDef Panetta was in Vietnam recently. I've had conversations with Russia. They, too, are a Pacific power. And so, you know, you ask, are we ready? Well, you know, that implies that this issue will inevitably have some kind of military resolution. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that China has some incredibly important and challenging economic issues that will allow this conversation and this relationship to build in ways that if we work it hard, it doesn't have to lead us to a confrontation with China. So I'm actually in the camp that says we've got to be clever enough, we've got to be mature enough to be able to, you know, to compartment issues into, literally to compartmentalize issues, to find areas of common interest and work those, and find areas where we don't have common interest and work those. But we don't have to lump everything into the same compartment, and in so doing have no relationship. So I think we're on a path that will allow us to continue to improve and mature the relationship with China. But look, you know, it needs work, and you have my commitment that the military is hard at work.
We've had President Putin reemerge in Russia. We don't know exactly where that leads, but any thoughts you have with regard to any changes that have become more evident since he did take over once again?
No, it's too early. I mean, he really didn't reemerge. He changed offices, you know. Let me tell you, though, one of the strongest relationships, I said about, you know, relationships really matter in this world. And it's not relationships managed over a Facebook page. I mean, this is real interaction. And one of my closest relationships of all the chiefs of defense, I'm a chief of defense for the United States. That's my title internationally, is with Nikolai Makarov, who is the chief of defense of Russia. And we've had some absolutely fascinating conversations about what they consider to be the threats about which they are most concerned. And I've had conversations about the threats about which we're most concerned. And on that basis, you know, we've got a work plan for mill-to-mill relationships, mostly being run out of the United States Army Europe, and mostly Army in this case, although Air Force somewhat, and Navy, we're starting to work toward a relationship in that regard. And I do think that on that basis, we will be able to have a conversation military to military, so that as the political issues kind of come and go. But there's another great example of where I think we don't have to lump everything into one pile. So we were very candid that we're disappointed in the Syrian and the Russian position towards Syria. But on the other hand, we're working with them on issues like counter-narcotics, piracy. We're working with them on the logistics of movement into and out of Afghanistan on the northern distribution network. So we've got plenty of places where we're working with them, and we have a few where we're not. And I think it's, you know, the effort here is to take, you know, take these two pieces of the rope and try to tie them together.
Moving a little closer to home, in recent days, the chair of the Senate Committee on Intelligence was quoted as saying she believed some of the leaks regarding sensitive intelligence programs and activities came from the White House. Assuming this is true, is this a normal practice, or is it a step beyond past boundaries for leaks in Washington?
How about those 49ers, huh? So I was over at the new stadium yesterday, met Coach Harbaugh, shook the hands of every one of those young men. Quite a remarkable experience. Terrific, really. Yeah. And, you know, they didn't tell me anything about what they were planning for this coming year. So what else you want to know? No, look, I testified on the Hill last week. You know, there was a House Armed Services Committee about leaks. Look, I have enough trouble keeping my own house in order without wondering about other colors' houses, other people's houses of other colors. I mean, I can tell you that leaks are dangerous. They're dangerous to our national security. If they're current, you know, or give away sources and methods, they can be dangerous to those who serve. And so I do what I can inside of that five-sided building. And SecDef, Secretary Panetta, is acting very aggressively to try to make sure that we protect the information that's entrusted to our care. That's the issue, by the way. This information is entrusted to our care. And we're doing what we can to get our house in order.
Now we're going to give you a tough one.
Yeah, nice try.
I was delighted to see that you have a master's in English. Mm-hmm. And the question really is, would you now recommend that more of our young people put their time at college into the arts as opposed to the technology and the other areas that seem to be the area of interest of most conversations today?
Yeah. You know, I think that I just want, you know, young men or women going through our education system to find something that inspires them. You know, our secondary education in this country is in some serious disrepair. You may or may not know that only one out of every four young men or women in America can get into the military. And that's either because of academic credentials or in some cases physical credentials. Some cases, you know, issues of, you know, minor misconduct as they've grown up. But the point is we shouldn't feel very good about that as Americans when only one out of every four young men or women can get into our force. Now, some of it is because we hold our standards pretty high. And I'm not willing to lower the standard in order to improve that percentage. I think we ought to lift the issue of education up. So, you know, I think the advice that I give to the young men and women who I kind of mentor or oversee or have a conversation with about, you know, whether it's more important to study science and technology or the humanities, I think I'm a personal believer in someone having access to information on both sides of that equation, and secondly, to be a lifelong learner. I mean, I mentioned right at the beginning of my remarks today that I periodically get out of Washington and I go on a campaign of learning. And that's literally, when I tell the staff, I want to go here and I want to learn. That's the mission. I got to learn. And that's how we measure whether it was a successful trip or not. You know, what did I learn? And if the answer is I didn't learn anything, then one of them gets fired and I find somebody else. So somebody better teach me something in this setting, actually. Or some of them are good. So anyway, I am deeply committed. And incidentally, technology today makes learning so accessible and so interactive, you know, that there's really no reason we can't do this. I am a little bit worried that we got to break some paradigms. You know, internal to the military, for example, we have a PowerPoint paradigm. You know, thou shalt not learn anything unless it's off of a PowerPoint slide. And I find that to be really distracting and counterproductive. Now I hope I hope somebody from Microsoft isn't here who's in charge of their PowerPoint division or something. But no, seriously, I think emerging technologies open the aperture for learning in ways that we haven't even yet really imagined. And but we got to grip it.
Okay, I'm going to kind of circle back to some of the earlier comments that you made dealing with both the budget and bases and what have you. Why do we need 700 or so military bases around the world?
I imagine by that number you're probably counting continental United States. I should have this number committed to memory. The answer is we don't need all of our bases everywhere, to include in this country, although that's an enormously contentious issue, as you know, when we try to close bases around the continental United States. So we do have we are somewhat inefficient in that regard. But if you're asking, do I believe we should have bases around the world? The answer is yes. I mean, I think there's two things we do very well. One is we go someplace and we live there and we immerse ourselves into other cultures. And in so doing, by the way, we make them better, but importantly, we make ourselves better. We grew up in an army that was largely deployed to Germany. At one point, 350,000 soldiers in Germany. And we lived there on and off for 11 years, and our kids grew up there with us. And I'm telling you, there's something about living in another culture for a period of time that is enormously developmental. And so I am an advocate of having the right number of, let's call them, bases that provide those fixed establishments, you know, with our most important allies. But then the other issue is rotational exercises. So, for example, we just put four littoral combat ships. That's our newest ship in the inventory. We'll manage them out of Singapore. That's an important phrase. We're not basing them in Singapore. They will be managed out of Singapore, and they'll do engagement activities throughout the region with Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, and so forth. And then we just put 2,500 Marines in Darwin that will rotate on literally a rotational basis so they can train. One of the ways we get really good at what we do is we put ourselves into new and unfamiliar environments. And so I am a strong advocate of keeping the force moving and learning. And part of that is our basing strategy.
The next questions are all focused around the Middle East, and I'll try to group them a bit. First of all, with regard to Iraq, we pulled out. In recent days, we've seen a number of bombings and other disruptions take place with heavy casualties. In Afghanistan, we still see problems emerging in some of the areas that where the military, the NATO troops have moved out. What do we believe now is the outlook for the area? How do we think in terms of Afghanistan, for example, after 2014? What is likely to be the case, and how will they develop from there?
Afghanistan, first of all, I've served in both places, and and they're so different. I mean, there is no template here, you know. But let me contrast Afghanistan and Iraq a bit for context to answer the question. Iraq, enormous economic potential, a long history of nationhood, moderate religion, education system, agriculture, and importantly, water in that part of the world. So it's always been my belief that Iraq has the capability to, you know, given the opportunity to pull itself up by the bootstraps, if you will, and to become a stable platform in the Middle East. Afghanistan has none of those benefits. You know, it's got an extraordinarily weak economy. It doesn't have much of a history, actually, of nationhood. It's got incredibly complex tribal interactions. Doesn't have as many of the religious issues. In fact, has almost none of the same religious issues as Iraq, but has exponentially more challenging tribal issues. I mean, from one valley to the next. In that context, you know, the young men and women that we have sent over there to try to make those situations more stable, better, try to give the people that live there a chance to take control of their own destiny. Look, it's been really hard. I mean, when people ask me, how do you feel about Afghanistan today, I answer the question, say simply, you know, it is actually possible for violence and progress to coexist inside of a country. And that's really the way I describe Afghanistan right now. Incredible progress. And yet there is still violence. And, you know, we debate constantly about whether it's up or down, or, you know, is it lingering? Is the Taliban more or less confident about itself? So you asked me what happens post-14. Probably the most important thing that's happened lately is that at Chicago, at the NATO summit in May, the 28 nations of NATO decided that they would commit to a long-term relationship as an alliance. But even more important, right before that, the United States agreed to a long-term security relationship for 10 years out beyond 2014. Now, we haven't really defined what that means. And over the course of the next year or so, we'll decide what we think we should leave there on the ground, how much financial assistance we should provide. But I think it was an important statement to the Afghans, for sure, to the Pakistanis, you know, that we were not going to leave an unstable Afghanistan on their western flank, to the Taliban, who at some level were probably, you know, waiting us out. So we'll see how this goes, but I think that security framework agreement was an important moment.
We're still in the same Middle East for a bit. Both Syria and Iran are struggling to contain dissident factions within their countries. How do you see these challenges, and how are their governments going to handle them? How do you see this playing out in the weeks ahead? And finally, what role can the U.S. play to help stabilize the area?
Was that Syria? I missed the front part.
Well, it was a combination of Syria and Iran.
Wow. It's like saying Hatfields and McCoys. Let me, that's a sort of a question that sits at about 10,000 feet of elevation. Let me jump up to 30,000 feet for a minute. I don't think anybody really is entirely certain what this thing called the Arab Spring means. I mean, I've been trying to learn as much about it. I've been to the region and visited all the countries. I haven't been to Syria, but I've been to notably every country from Turkey down through Egypt. Spent 2 years of our lives living in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. I mean, this is really complex stuff, and I don't know that anybody is entirely sure what will happen. Probably Tom Friedman maybe be the most thoughtful guy on the issue of the Arab Spring, and so I'm kind of aligned with him in the sense that, you know, we had this liberal, let's call it liberal revolution that was somewhat hijacked, you know, depending on what country it happened to occur in, hijacked in some cases by the military, some cases by Islamists, you know, Muslim Brotherhood. And, you know, that I think that's sort of an evolutionary issue. Tom Friedman believes that, you know, you'll have this period of initially of instability, but that the next generation, you know, that as these groups now are responsible for, who have previously been on the sidelines, are now responsible for actually governing, that will tamper the violence, and then eventually the next generation will seize the opportunity that they've been presented. So in that context, Syria is, you know, the next in the string. This one is probably more difficult. No, not probably. This one is more difficult because you've got so many different interests. You mentioned Iran's interest in Syria, and that's not a benign interest in our view. And so that is the most unhelpful part of a potential outcome. But, you know, we are engaging with our partners on the periphery of Syria, Turkey, Jordan, Israel, notably. We haven't yet begun discussions with NATO, but Turkey is a NATO member, so at some point I'm certain we will. And, you know, we're trying to forge some kind of diplomatic and international interest in the level of violence and in the potential problem that chemical and biological weapons could create. So this is a case where all of the difficulties in the other Arab Spring moments are manifested and magnified in Syria, and this is one where we need to continue to try to shape it diplomatically before we apply other diplomatically and economically, certainly before we would think about applying the military instrument of power.
It's more than 20 years since the end of the Cold War and more than 10 years since 9/11. What do you think about as far as the greatest unseen threat that could suddenly be on your doorstep and having to deal with? Is there any particular arena that you are most concerned about?
Well, I alluded to it in my remarks. I think the single, you know, when I measure risk on behalf of the Secretary of Defense, on behalf of the nation, my job is to assess risk. And the way we assess risk is on the likelihood of occurrence and on the consequence. So there are some things, let's take a nuclear exchange. A nuclear exchange, the consequence is just unthinkable. The likelihood is fairly low. And then there are things that are high likelihood, like a terrorist attack. But the consequence tends to be manageable, albeit horrific for those, you know, right at the moment. But in terms of the threat to the nation, you know, a terrorist attack would be highly likely, but relatively modest consequence, depending on what it was. But anyway, that's the calculus. So let me put cyber into that mix. So you said, are there any things that are kind of unknown, potentially silent, the black swan, if you know the book, The Black Swan. Cyber is the black swan. I mean, because we don't know exactly what capabilities exist out there. And so, but we do know our vulnerability. And so cyber is the threat. that concerns me the most, both because we're not entirely sure whether nation states, independent actors, I mean, you remember the great train robbery that we used to read about, the great train robbery in the 19th century? You know, you'd read about the great, or there was a movie about it. You know, it was two guys robbing a train that had 100 people on it. You know, how could that happen? How did two people rob 100 people? Well, you know, cyber, one guy with a laptop can rob 100,000 people at the blink of an eye. I mean, that's the power out there. And we're vulnerable. And so cyber for me is the black swan. And, as I said, we're pushing and trying to both understand it better, be part of a whole of government approach to it. But if you're asking me which of the unknown threats worry me the most, cyber.
Going all the way back to what has been the foundation of military, the foot soldier. How do you see the foot soldier's role 20 years from today? Is it largely displaced by robots and drones and things of that nature? And then I think a follow-on question to that is, I know we have a major effort underway to help rehabilitate the young men and women coming back from the combat zones. What more, if anything, do you have on the agenda to try to implement to make that even a more effective program?
Yeah. You know, the question about robotics, if you will. I was out at Google yesterday and drove. No, I didn't drive. I sat in the driverless car. They have a driverless car out there that is rather remarkable, to tell you the truth. So robotics, clearly, and we already use unmanned aerial systems, as you well know. So there's a lot of unmanned things on the battlefield. But if you ask me, you know, whether they will, on a one-for-one basis, be traded off for the foot soldier, if you will, whether that's a sailor, an airman, a marine, or a Coast Guardman, not on my watch. I mean, look, the most powerful tool in the United States of America's military arsenal is a man or woman sitting with teammates, you know, in a unit that's diverse in every way. It's diverse in terms of its ethnic background. It's diverse in terms of its religious preference. It's diverse in terms of its sexual preference. I mean, we've got a force of men and women who represent this country. And when they go someplace, the power of that image is unmistakable, and it's profound. And so as we balance the force in the future, you know, deciding how much technology, how much human dimension, you can count on me anyway to always argue that we need to remain the force we are, enable it with some of these technologies, and in some cases trade it off. But the point is, you know, as I said, the most impressive part of United States military power are the men and women who put on the uniform. As to your question about what more can be done about helping them through transitions, and we do. We have an enormous challenge both existing today. I mean, look, we've been at war now in Iraq and Afghanistan longer than any other conflict in our history. So at some level, we have to continue to learn. What does 10 years of conflict mean to the human spirit, you know, to the ability of a young man or woman to bear the load, whether it's the physical load or the psychological load that we place on their backs. And we are learning, and we've come a long way. We have a long way to go. And by the way, this is a challenge that we will have to confront for decades. You know, the last World War I veteran, Frank Buckles, died in February. So that's the magnitude of taking care of veterans. And the nation, this isn't a military responsibility. This is the nation's responsibility. So one of the other reasons I'm out here in Silicon Valley was I was actually asking both Google and Facebook how they could help. You know, they're connected. 75-78% of soldiers and Marines in Afghanistan communicate back to their families over Facebook. And so what we're trying to figure out is if there's a way, you know, to connect and start to, you know, potentially have a positive effect on some of these behavioral health issues, suicide and all that. We're working closely with the Veterans Administration because as we shrink, You know, we've already decided based on the $487 billion cost cut, we're going to lose about 100,000 soldiers and about 20,000 Marines. So we're going to pass a lot of these young men or women who have been serving into the private sector. Now, by the way, that's good news for the private sector. Let me give you one little thought to carry out of here today. The American economy needs soldiers, sailors, airmen or Marines, and Coast Guardsmen more than the soldier, sailor, airman or Marine need them. They're an incredibly competent, flexible, resilient, disciplined, courageous group. And so if you carry anything out of here today, you could take out of here that I need your help in transitioning these kids into the private sector. But you'll be better for it. Your business will be better for it because they're terrific.
We've reached a point where this will have to be our last question, unfortunately. While the all-volunteer military has proven beneficial to the country, it also has many negative aspects. Do you see any benefit or possibility to a combination of a volunteer and a selective draft of some sort that would help to get more of the young people interested and possibly involved with the military?
Yeah, Stan McChrystal and I talk about this all the time. He's one of my dear friends, and he just gave a speech out at Aspen on the issue of universal service. So here, just a couple of reflections. First of all, we might say it's going to be universal. It's never universal. That's not the way it works. I mean, you know, there'll be enough exemptions and enough exceptions, you know, that it does become selective. And then when you get to it being a selective service, you know, you have to answer that question, not me. I mean, I have to help you answer it. But fundamentally, what do you want your force to be? How diverse do you want it to be? Economically diverse, culturally diverse, ethnically diverse. And I think we're able to manage the all-volunteer force, you know, through accessions and attrition. We're able to manage it better. Third, it's the kind of world I've described to you today, it's not a pickup game. You know, this is not a pick. There's two things about warfare today that I'd like you to remember. One is it's not a pickup game. You know, you can't take a bunch of kids and, you know, pick the tall one in a basketball game. Okay, pick all the tall ones and you short guys, you're on the other team. It's not a pickup game. It's a security environment that demands a level of professionalism and continuity that I don't think we could get out of a volunteer force. And the other thing about it that I want you to remember about warfare is it's always better to play away games, especially when you're talking about war. So, you know, in that context, it's my belief that what the nation needs is the all-volunteer force. And the final thing I'll say about that, but by the way, I'm not against having that debate. In fact, it'd be a healthy debate. But the other thing about building the force is, remember I said, right now, today, only 1 in 4 can get in. So you've already have essentially a selective service, you know, when you come right down to it. But look, you know, whatever we do to the force in the future, you can count on me to, you know, to express, you know, open, transparently, and candidly, you know, what force you are buying for America. And I know the all-volunteer force is a little more expensive, but look what it's done over the last 25 years.
Well, thank you, General Dempsey, for a very enlightening set of comments. I would also like to thank our audiences on radio, television, and the Internet. As I said earlier, today's program has been held in association with the Marines Memorial Association. Now, two quick announcements. First of all, we want to remind everyone to please remain seated until General Dempsey has left the room. And also, we would like to ask the wounded warriors to please come forward and meet here at the front of the room immediately. So with that, I'm George Scalise. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.